irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
My gosh, I hate to say this, but you know, this is Russ. I'm happy to say that, but Jim quit. He's gone.
Jim is gone. Yes.
Jim is gone. We're going to have a little service for him later.
Yes.
No, Jim is actually home recovering from a little, I was going to say a minor surgery, but I guess it's pretty major, although he sounds like, I talked to him the day of the surgery, he was like sounding great.
Bouncing back like a champ.
I think they have some good drugs for him. But anyway,
he would demand it.
Yes, definitely. This is Russ Avison. This is The Writer's Block, and I'm joined with Courtney Joyner. How about that? That's a good way to put that. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm a poor substitute for Bobby Jean.
No, only she looks better. That's the only thing.
Yeah,
she's much cuter. But other than that, I'm very happy to have you here with me. And we have a great guest tonight, Casey Tevertiller, which we're going to bring in just a minute. But you know, before the show, Courtney, I'm so happy you're here for this reason. Before the show, we were chatting, and Courtney said to me, well, you know, for people who are really not students of the West, and I said, oh, no, that's me. Completely. I'm at the beginnings of learning about the West. And so I feel tonight I'm not going to be much better than a moderator.
No, you underrate yourself. We have great conversations all the time.
Well, because I ask a lot of questions.
And but, I give a lot of wrong answers.
Yeah. Well, you know, we should get this party rolling, I guess. So, you know, would you like to, you know more about Casey than I do. Would you like to say a little bit about him?
Well, Casey, first of all, has written a tremendous book here about Wyatt Earp and really shredding, I would say, the curtain of mythology around this man, who is, by no small argument, perhaps along with Billy the Kid, the most famous figure of the American West.
Absolutely.
And, of course, Casey has a tremendous background as a newspaper reporter and also, of course, as a sports reporter. And so this is quite an honor, because this is a not only is it a great book, it is an important book, I believe, historically, and just sets the record straight on so many issues.
It does. And, you know, me not or being a brand new student of the West, you know, Jim got me started with his books. But to read this, and I thought, oh, my gosh, here's this book. And it is, I'm going to tell you, this book is 300 and almost 400 pages, little tiny type. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I have to plow through this thing. And it is fascinating. And so many things I learned that I had no idea even went on. I now feel I know about Tombstone, which was really interesting. But rather than you and I discuss it, why don't we bring Casey in to talk with us. Casey, you there?
I'm right here.
Welcome to The Writer's Block.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Russ.
Well, I had nothing to do with it, but I'm happy you're here. And as you heard... Go ahead, please.
It's my pleasure to be here. So,
well, let's start out. Courtney was just saying that you're a sports writer, and here you are writing a book about the Old West, Wyatt Earp, the life behind the legend. Where did this interest come from? Let's start there.
Well, I grew up in Santa Cruz, a little ways up the coast from you. And when I was a child, my grandfather had been a working cowboy in the early years of the 20th century. And after he was a cowboy, he became chief of police here in Santa Cruz. But when he was a young cowboy, when he was in his teens, some of the old Arizona hands drifted into California and started telling the stories that they'd heard about Wyatt Earp. And the stories they'd heard about Wyatt Earp were the bad stories, that he was a bad guy, that he was a murderer and a killer and did all kinds of bad things. And at the same time that my grandfather was telling me these stories, the There's some feedback on the line, so I'm having trouble kind of.
Hey, do you know, Casey, it would be really easy. Would you like me to try, or actually, do you want to try and call in? Or would you like me to call you right back?
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm going to call you right back.
Okay.
All right. And while
sounds good.
All right, go ahead and hang up. We'll call you right back. And while we're doing that, we're gonna let Courtney talk to you guys. I'm going to try and figure this thing out. I knew it wasn't
working.
Well, we can
absolutely figure this out. And would this be appropriate?
Sure. That's a good place. Yeah.
This is a perfect place.
Yeah, and, pay some bills.
Yes. As we mentioned, Target Freight Management every show. And Bobby, Gene, and Jim certainly do. And we mentioned they have a full truckload service that's the best in the industry. But have we mentioned that Target Freight Management truckload is the finest in the industry and gets your freight there every time on time at the rates you need for your transportation costs? Call today at 1-844-653-7789 and tell them you heard it on the Writer's Block. And they'll have a little something extra for you. It's our good friends at TFM.
And you can go ahead and continue. There's more on there. We have
much
to say.
Yes, there absolutely is. And as I said, and while we're at it, if you're an LTL shipper, you're probably looking for the best rates with the least hassle, and you can call Target Freight Management. And their customized transportation management system is just the ticket to get your freight moved your way. And call Target Freight Management today at 1-888-653-1323 or go to their website, which is www.targetfmi.com on the web. Call today. You won't be sorry you did.
Okay. Well, Casey, are you there?
I'm here.
All right. Does it sound any better?
We'll have to find out.
All right.
Well, we started beautifully. So
yeah, it did. I thought we were a go, and then... Anyway, you were talking about your... it was your father?
My grandfather had been chief of police in Santa Cruz.
Right.
And so as a child, I'm 7, 8 years old, 9 years old, we'd sit and watch the reruns of the old Wyatt Earp TV show with Hugh O'Brien, and Wyatt Earp would be portrayed as this incredible hero doing all these wonderful things, and my grandfather would be telling the stories of Wyatt Earp that he'd heard as Wyatt Earp the villain. And we'd be getting True West magazine and other Western magazines all portraying Earp as a villain. So for as long as I can remember from my childhood, I was fascinated by the concept, not by the gunfight, not by the big trial that happened afterward, not by the vendetta, but what fascinated me from the time that I was a little child was the concept that one man could be portrayed as such a hero and a villain, that there could be such a dichotomous legacy for one man at the same time. And so from the time I was a child, I was fascinated by the story and wanted to find out whether Earp was really a hero or a villain.
Well, Case, my question, in fact, Russ and I were talking about this earlier. How early was it that you discovered Stuart N. Lake's biography? Because that kind of became the Bible for the Earp story.
Well, by 1960, Lake was pretty much discredited. What happened was Frank Waters came out with a book called The Earp Brothers of Tombstone in 1960, and it set off chaos all around the Western world because Waters portrayed Earp as just an incredible villain, the brains behind stage robberies, a terrible human being who was out cheating on his lonely wife sitting at home, and just a truly rotten guy. And so by 1960, Lake had pretty much been discredited, and Lake passed away in 1964. And through the 1960s, it was pretty much a time of reevaluation when Earp was considered a villain in most of the eyes of America. So I didn't actually read, I read Waters early, but I didn't actually read Lake until later because it was supposed to be a myth by then.
Well, there had been, I guess, really that distillation. Of course, I know he was not named as Wyatt Earp, but I guess Law and Order with Walter Huston is considered really the first adaptation of Lake's book. Of course, written by John Huston. I believe it's his first screenwriting credit. And then, of course, when Fox did Frontier Marshal, which was the title of Lake's book, was it not?
It was.
Yes, and then with Randolph Scott, and then essentially remade it, but of course turned it, John Ford, turning it into the tremendous My Darling Clementine, and of course Ford knew Wyatt Earp.
Hey, we're going to break in for a minute. We have someone else calling in. Welcome to the Writer's Block. Hello?
Yeah, I'm trying to listen, not talk.
Oh.
Oh, well, you called us, so we thought you wanted to chat with us. Have you got a question?
Well, it says click to listen live, and I click to listen live, and all that comes up is this phone number.
Well, here you are. So say hi to Casey, and then we'll let you listen.
Okay.
Hi.
Okay. Well, that was interesting. That's actually happened to us before. What's worse is when you have someone that calls in about a question on the previous show, and they call and say, well, you know, I've been studying stocks now for 22 years. I say, well, that's great. Why are you calling us?
Yes. Well, I was actually, yes, as the guest, the very first show, I believe it was Jim's cousin called in, and she was trying to find her car keys or something, and that was the big question. Did you see these on the couch?
How funny.
As you bring up the movies, let me tell you a little bit about what's happened, because this is what I think is really exciting. As I said, Lake was considered discredited by the 1960s, and in the course of the research, several researchers, Gary Roberts, Jeff Wheat, Chuck Horning, S.J. Reedhead, and I discovered that Frank Waters' material was actually false, as was that of several other writers. So most of what people believed about Wyatt Earp from the beginning has turned out to be false. So as incredible as it seems, and you just brought this up, Wyatt Earp is arguably the most famous non-president of the 19th century.
Oh, absolutely.
One of the most famous men in American history. We are almost starting over and trying to understand his story and trying to find all the new pieces of the story on a man who is remarkably famous. And yet, what we're finding out that I think stuns me almost every day that I wake up is that the real story of Wyatt Earp is far more interesting than what was portrayed by Lake or Waters or any of the other people who perpetrated fraud on history.
But nothing is more exciting than our next caller.
Russ.
Hey, Jimmy, how are you?
Doing good, man.
Well,
I thought I'd give y'all a holler because I see you got Henry there and Court and Casey.
Yeah, you know,
hi, Jim.
Hey, what do you say, man? You know, I'm just amazed that all you guys could find it to get together. So, there you go. There you have it.
How you feeling, Jim? Are you recovering well?
Yeah. Hey, what do you say? I'm laying in my bed right at the moment.
Okay, well, quit bragging, okay?
Yep. I got to tell you, though, it's just horrible if you have to go up and go to the restroom.
Okay, oh. TMI.
Yes, thank you for contributing that.
We have empty water bottles.
You know, you guys are so welcome.
Yeah. All right, Jimmy, well, we're going to get on with it. Do you have any questions for Casey before we go?
I don't, but I have his number. If I have any to call him later on, I will. That's okay with you, Casey.
Happy to talk to you.
Oh, great. Looking forward to it. And Henry, have yourself a good one, my friend.
I'm sure he will.
Okay.
All right, take care, Jim.
All right, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. I had to answer for him because it's his show.
Well, I think that was totally appropriate. Is there recovering in his hospital?
He sounds a little bit on the drug side.
Just a tad bit, yes, referring to Henry Park, who's not here, but right. We'll be calling in later. Well, Casey, getting back what Russ and I were talking about, that one of the more interesting things here, not only with Earp, of course, is that he lived for such a long time into this century. And
he did indeed. He lived until 1929, and he was pretty much the last of the old-time gunfighters, and he wound up living in Los Angeles at the end of his life.
And, of course, he associated with so many movie people like Ford and like Tom Mix and Harry Carey and people like that. And that's just a it's just fascinating to think that there he was, the true figure of history, often with men who would ultimately play him, although of course John Wayne knew him but never did portray him.
And well, the story on John Wayne, John Wayne told Hugh O'Brien that when John Wayne was a young prop boy, of course he was then Marion Morrison, and you know John Wayne's job was to take care of people on the set, and Wyatt Earp would come out and visit the movie sets, and of course Earp had a lot of friends like Tom Mix and many others, and so Earp would come out on the movie sets and sit and tell stories, and John Wayne would kind of be in the background, and he was just a kid. He was 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, and he'd listen to Wyatt Earp tell stories, and what Wayne told Hugh O'Brien was that he used what he learned from Earp to help formulate kind of his Western persona. And of course, there's no more on that story. All we know is what Hugh O'Brien said, but it's pretty remarkable when you look at the connection of Wyatt Earp to today. It's really Wyatt Earp as a person, and his story really transcends history.
Well, Ford, and there's a wonderful, the documentary that his grandson did about his grandfather, and there's that wonderful scene Russ and I were talking about where Ford shows Jimmy Stewart the rifle that Wyatt Earp presented to him.
Yep.
And Ford had always claimed that that moment in Clementine during the gunfight at OK Corral with the stagecoach going through and using the dust as a smokescreen was something that he said Earp had told him personally. And, of course, that's the only time we've ever seen it in any, you know, version of that particular conflict. So, I don't know. John Ford liked to embroider, but I'd like to think it was true.
It's nothing at all like what happened. It's not even, even close. I mean, it's one of those things where you hear John Ford tell that story, and it kind of it's exciting to hear it. And then you go look at the movie and you say, what the heck was he thinking? Because it is nothing at all like what happened. The gunfight itself was just, it was a big mistake. It was law enforcement gone wrong, and where everything fouled up that could.
Sounds like a headline of today's news, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. And it winds up being the most famous 30 seconds in the history of the West, probably.
That's right. And, of course, part of it actually took place in that alley next to the hotel, didn't it?
Well, it was a vacant lot next to, between a house owned by a man named Harwood and Fly's Photo Gallery. And it was actually behind the OK Corral. The gunfight was on Fremont Street in Tombstone. Earp always referred to it as the street fight in Tombstone. And the vacant lot that was back behind the OK Corral but had an opening where people could walk into the OK Corral. So it wasn't exactly in the OK Corral. It wasn't in the OK Corral. It was in a vacant lot in the street, but it was adjoining the OK Corral.
All right. You know what? We're going to take a little bit of a break, and then when we come back, how about giving us a rundown of what really did happen, the gunfight of OK Corral? This is the Writer's Block. We'll be back in just a minute.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Courtney Joyner, and I'm here with the great Mr. Russ Avalon, and we are talking to the author and grand historian, Casey Tefertiller, about his fantastic book about Wyatt Earp. I just cannot recommend this book highly enough.
Wow.
Thank you
that's
very much.
Really nice.
Well, it is true, and Casey's is what we've been talking about, of course, is the astonishing mythology that grew up around this one man while he was living. And I'd like to just quick go to that and the idea of what media was like at the time of the OK Corral, at the time when Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday were building their reputations, what newspapers did and Penny Dreadfuls did. And legend building was kind of a whole different business in those days.
Well, the Associated Press was really just getting its start. And the Associated Press had come to Tombstone, and the Tombstone epitaph provided the material for the AP. So after the gunfight, it went out on the wires all over the nation, and you can look in newspapers all over the country and find articles about the fight in Tombstone. And Tombstone had also already become a big issue because realized people from all over the country were investing money there. There was a ton of money out of the rich areas of Pennsylvania investing. San Francisco mining exchanges, were all kinds of money was coming out of San Francisco. So everybody was watching Tombstone very closely. And even in some places, some had newspaper correspondents. The San Diego Union had a newspaper correspondent in Tombstone reporting on what was going, and it was actually a woman in that day and age. They had a female newspaper correspondent reporting the news. So there was a lot of attention being paid to Tombstone, and the gunfight, the events before, because things had gotten pretty crazy before, then the gunfight, the preliminary hearing that followed, and the vendetta were all national news out of this one dusty little spot in southern Arizona.
And too, when people would read anything at that time, it was taken as fact. It existed in print. I think it had a lot more weight to it than
it carried a lot of weight. But then, as now, I think people believed. But one of the great lines somebody once told me about the internet was, a woman was talking to me, and she said, "I read this about you on the internet." And she said, "Is it true?" And I said, "No, none of that's true." And she said, "Wow, I was worried." Then she said, "Nobody believes the internet." And I said, "But you just believed the internet." And she said, "Well, yeah, that's right." And I think it was probably pretty much the same back then. You read it, and you kind of believed it and you kind of didn't. And what made it so difficult is that there were contradictory stories all the time. There were two newspapers in Tombstone that often ran contradictory stories on things. So, yeah, people believed it. And in fact, you make a very important point, because that was sort of how the anti-Earp legacy was built. After the Earps left Arizona, the epitaph was taken over by a Democrat, and the epitaph had been a Republican paper. Then it was taken over by a Democrat, and the same newspaper that had run all the pro-ERP stories suddenly switched and was running all the anti-ERP stories. So most of what the people in the area were reading and believing in the anti-ERP stories came out of the Democrat, with a very biased editor who wasn't there at the time telling false stories. And that's how people, how much of the anti-ERP sentiment was carried on.
But what was the impetus for the bad stories, you know, in the first place? I mean, you always hear, I mean, like now we have this election going on, and we have stories going on about both of our candidates who are both widely hated. But there's still some threads of truth that go through it. And here you have stories about Wyatt Earp that are 180 degrees polarized. I mean,
absolutely.
How did this happen, and why did it happen?
Well, it was pretty much a newspaper war. It was the Nugget and the Epitaph were in conflict. The Epitaph, with Mayor John Klum, who was the editor and publisher, was sympathetic to the Earps, and the Nugget was run by a man named Harry Woods, who was actually the undersheriff to John Behan. And there was this constant political war going back and forth. And it was just a constant stream of pro-Behan, pro-Earp, and Earp and Behan were at odds. Behan had sympathies with the cowboys. And that led to a whole lot of false stories. During the Spicer hearing, which followed, it was a hearing under Judge Wells Spicer, and it followed the gunfight, and it took a month. Imagine this, you have the gunfight, three cowboys are killed, three of the YRT party are wounded but recover. All these people are laying in the dust, and 3 days later, they've got a coroner's inquest, and a few days after that, they're at a preliminary hearing to determine the guilt or innocence with the ERPs up on murder charges. That lasts a month, and during the course of the Spicer hearing, several witnesses accused the ERPs of committing cold-blooded murder. Ike Clanton, a name that's probably been heard by many of your listeners, goes on the stands and accuses the ERPs of being behind the stage robberies. So how did this happen? It happened because the bad guys turned around and accused the Marshall's posse of really being the outlaws. It was a remarkable way of doing things, almost the same way things are done today.
But it's also...
And so a lot of the stories, yeah, the anti-ERP stories, were built on accusations of the outlaws that, as we can best tell, were absolutely false.
Well, it seems to me, though, that, I mean, Wyatt Earp, as you said, lived until 1929. And prior to his death, a lot of the other people involved in a lot of these stories were gone. So wasn't there enough fact that came forward between, say, the time of the OK Corral and Wyatt Earp's later years that the true facts would have come out? I mean, there's still, even today, in reading your book, there's still controversy about things.
There's still a great deal of controversy, but the answer to your question is absolutely not. The short version of what happened is Wyatt Earp, after the gunfight, Wyatt Earp was fairly well known. He wound up in San Francisco, became kind of a well-known bon vivant who had too much of a fondness for liquor. And in December of 1896, Wyatt Earp was selected to referee a prize fight between... that would have been the equivalent of the world championship. It's way more complicated than that, more complicated than I should get into. But Wyatt Earp made a very poor refereeing call. It was the fight was almost certainly fixed. Whether or not Wyatt Earp was part of the fix is very hard to determine. But it became this huge controversy where Wyatt Earp was pilloried around the country. And people would refer to, for years, people would call bad decisions somebody was being ERP'd. And so ERP was just pilloried. I mean, he called a foul. Bob Fitzsimmons was fighting Tom Sharkey, and Fitzsimmons was winning the fight going away, just beating Sharkey to a pulp. They got to the eighth round. Fitzsimmons comes with a fighting in a low stance. He comes with an uppercut that Earp believed hit Sharkey's groin and knocked Sharkey out. Sharkey falls down. A moment later, somebody seems to yell at him, and he starts grabbing his groin and writhing around in pain. Earp goes over to look at him, and it appears that he's been fouled, and so Earp calls the foul. After that, a number of just incredibly crazy things happened. One of the strangest was Sharkey invited reporters up to his hotel room, and so the reporters all come up to his hotel room. Sharkey pulls back the sheets and shows a badly bruised groin area. After that, doctors come out and they say the same thing could have been done by injecting iodine into his groin to make it look like he was fouled. And it's pretty clear, it seems very likely that it was not a foul, and that Earp was either hoodwinked or part of the fix, and that the fight was the Sharkey's people fixed the fight. But Earp received such bad press after that, that what happened to Wyatt Earp was really interesting. Wyatt Earp just shut up. He didn't do very many newspaper interviews. He didn't talk at length to the press. He just kind of avoided being a celebrity and pretty much hid out for about 2 decades. And during that 2 decades, stories were going on. The West was rediscovered, and there were stories all over. And most of the stories portrayed Earp as a villain. So if you go through your newspaper.com or old newspapers, you'll find stories, these incredible, absurd stories about what happened in Tombstone that are completely false. And it was almost like the Saturday Evening Post in, I believe it was 1919, did a big article on Earp, and it was almost like Earp said, enough is enough, and he decided to finally try and tell his story and get the story right. And so for the next decade, Earp looked for a way to tell his story and get it right, at least as he saw it. And from that point, that's how Stuart Lake eventually would come into the picture.
Well, I actually, about 2 years ago, did a commentary for the Frank Perry movie Doc. And Pete Hamill, when he was just so proud of the screenplay that he had written. Of course, Pete Hamill, a tremendous writer.
Yep.
But he had taken that other tact. He had found all the anti-ERP material and laced it together into that script. And the movie is not good and so lopsided. And as we know now, even looking at it, you can see just these incredible historical inaccuracies. But at the time the film was made, because it was anti-establishment, basically, by trashing Wyatt Earp, that was the tack that they took. And therefore, it was kind of part of the agenda of the era in which the movie was made. And so now it exists more as like this bizarre time capsule than anything else. And it's completely wrong.
Well, that was from the era when Frank Waters and another writer named Ed Bartholomew just dominated the scene on Wyatt Earp. And they reached the conclusion that Wyatt Earp was a major villain, that he was the mastermind of the stage robberies, and that he was just the truly evil bad guy in the Tombstone affairs. And pretty much of that can be... It's funny, they were the debunkers in 1960, and then generations later were the debunkers. But what happened after that, a writer named Glenn Boyer came along, and he seemed more even-keeled, and he presented a number of stories, most notably I Married Wyatt Earp, which was supposedly the collected memoirs of Josephine Earp.
Yeah.
And it turned out that Boyer's work was fraudulent, too. So the three major writers in Earp history, from Lake, whose biography appeared in 1931, until the 1990s, turned out to be fraudulent. And that's why so much of the information that we have and that people believe on Earp turns out to be false. The writers wound up making up much of the story. This is why the whole thing is so exciting. It's almost like we're starting over, learning who Earp really was, what really happened, and getting a whole new understanding of the events and the time.
But isn't that also why I think everyone always returns to this story for the basis of movies and television shows? And Russ and I were talking earlier, because I've always enjoyed Gunfight at the OK Corral, although I certainly recognize what it is.
Great movie.
Wonderful. Particularly for me, it is Joe Van Fleet. I think that is the, for Big Nose Kate, that is probably the most, at least from a Hollywood standpoint, the most realistic portrayal of her. I said from a Hollywood standpoint. But,
well, let me tell you that actually, since we don't know the characters, it's hard to tell what's most realistic. But let me tell you about one of the most interesting parts of Big Nose Kate. Big Nose Kate left behind a memoir that Jack Burroughs, a writer out of San Jose, gave to me. And in it, she talks about what a wonderful guy Ringo was and how Ringo gave her the money to get out of town while Doc Holliday was in jail. Big Nose Kate, Haroni Holliday Elder, was befriending John Ringo at the same time that her common-law husband, Doc Holliday, was in jail.
Oh, yes.
Was this another love triangle?
Yeah,
I mean, we have the... There was... the great and well-known love triangle between Josephine Sarah Marcus, Sheriff John Bean, and Wyatt Earp. But Kate appears to have been in another love triangle of her own with Ringo and Doc Holliday.
Yes, Kate got around.
Kate got around. It was a pretty exciting time.
Yes. But I was going to say that for me, I mean, personally, and of course, this deals almost exclusively with The Vendetta and, of course, showing Ike Clanton played by Robert Ryan. But I've always liked the way they approached Hour of the Gun.
It's a great movie. It's not really a history movie, but it's a great movie. Almost every movie James Garner did was really good.
And so, yes, and I liked the way he portrayed Wyatt. It was very, he did it in a very, of course, single-minded way because this was about the vendetta. But I thought there was it was an interesting, not at least as far as the performances went, kind of a non-romantic approach, and almost, and since it's the same director's Gunfight, John Sturges, I think a going back against almost what he created in Gunfight at the OK Corral in some ways.
I think, by the way, I think we have Henry calling. Is that you, Henry?
Yes, it sure is. Hello.
Welcome. Welcome.
Hey, Henry.
Thank you. Hey, guys. I'm just enjoying this discussion immensely. I've got to read this book. I'm calling, among other reasons, because I'm working on an article for True West. You know, I'm the film editor. On Wyatt Earp for them. And I thought, Casey, I'd like to take advantage of your expertise if I could and ask you a couple of questions.
Sure.
Yeah. There have been so many good films, and they're all so different. You've touched on Frontier, Marshall of My Darling Clementine, Gunfight at the OK Corral. And, of course, in the two big ones of recent years, Wyatt Earp with Kevin Costner and Tombstone with Kurt Russell. Which of all of them do you consider the most historically accurate overall?
The screenplay that I have waiting to find a production company. I'm sure you've heard that before.
Yes, indeed. What would be your second choice?
Well, I think the problem is, as you know, Jeff Borey, who probably knows more about Wyatt Earp than anyone on Earth, was the... historical advisor for the movie Tombstone, and in that regard, the script for Tombstone is incredible. If you ever have the chance to read the original script, the writing, it's just incredible. And Kevin Jarre wrote the script and started off as director, and then they had all kinds of problems. Kurt Russell wound up doing a lot of the directing himself. So there's a lot of very good history in there, and then there's a lot of wild fantasy, and then there's absurdity. There's one thing that drove me absolutely nuts, and that was when Wyatt Earp and his pals were sitting around eating Chinese food with chopsticks. And I looked at that, and I grew up in the West. I grew up in a cowboy family. That simply wouldn't happen. If they were eating Chinese food, they would do it with a fork. Paladin might use chopsticks, but not Wyatt Earp. So, I mean, there are a lot of things, there are a lot of problems with it, but that's probably, it has a better sense of history. And I'll tell you what's absolutely brilliant about that line, why Kevin Jarre may be one of the great writers of all time, is that Kevin Jarre didn't let his ego get in the way of writing. What Kevin Jarre did was he used the best lines from real life. Sometimes he improved them a little bit, but he used the best lines from what really happened. If you can imagine, Henry, if you can imagine during the course of the gunfight, it lasts probably a little less than 30 seconds. There's all this shooting going on. At one time, Frank McLowry approaches Doc Holliday and levels his gun. A very unsteady, wounded Frank McLowry levels his gun at Doc Holliday and says, "I've got you now." Doc Holliday turns around to him and says, "You're a daisy if you have." Can you imagine that in the heat of all that's going on? Kevin Jarre took that line and changed it to "You're a daisy if you do," which has a little better ring. He used the best lines. I'm Your Huckleberry was a line that was used by one of the writers in the 1920s. We have no evidence that that's real. But Kevin Jarre took the best lines from both literature and reality and turned those lines into what I think is one of the great Westerns of all time. I don't think it's all that. It's nothing is perfectly accurate. We know so much more now than the folks did in 1990. As I say, I think the best Wyatt Earp movie is the next one to come along.
Right. But who is the best person, do you think, or should I say the most accurate to play Wyatt Earp?
Well, in my opinion, it would be Hugh O'Brien.
Ah.
And the reason for that is that looking at Wyatt Earp, if you read about him and you read what people say about him, he was just cat quick. He, have you ever known prize fighters or really top flight athletes who have incredible quickness? It would be like a shortstop on a baseball team, of a middleweight fighter who has really fast hands, great quickness. Hugh O'Brien was so athletic that he had that kind of quickness and that kind of ability, the ability to grab somebody's gun out of their hands as they're drawing it, where you could be so quick and so confident that you could do that. And Hugh O'Brien had that ability. Hugh O'Brien had a sternness about him. Wyatt Earp, as best we can understand him, was a guy who, he seemed to be dour, but he really liked laughing. And he had a very stern look, a stern approach. But what he really liked was somebody who could make him laugh. Bat Masterson could make him laugh. Doc Holliday could make him laugh. Sadie Marcus could make him laugh. And Wyatt spent most of his final years living as man and wife with Josephine Sarah Marcus, who he always called Sadie. And one of the great stories about him was told by the Welsh family. And Wyatt and Sadie lived in their attic during a good part of the 20s. And one member of the Welsh family could remember Sadie would do all these horrible things. She'd steal food from the Welshes. She'd go off all day gambling. And then she'd come home. And she'd walk in the door, and Wyatt would yell from upstairs, and ailing Wyatt would yell from upstairs, and he'd yell, "Sadie! Sadie!" And she'd go upstairs, and he was obviously a little upset. And within a few minutes, the Welsh girls could sit downstairs and hear Wyatt going from upstairs to Sadie talking to him, and she was giggling with a little high-pitched laughter. Now, Wyatt, if Wyatt would go into a burst of hilarity, it would be something to the effect of, "Ha! Ha! Ha!" And Sadie could make him laugh, if you consider that laughing.
It's close enough.
I'm sorry, right, Henry, I got all misdirected from whatever question you were asking me.
Huh? No, not at all. You gave me a really good reason to accept Hugh O'Brien, which I wanted to do anyway. Thank you so much. I can't wait to read the book.
I hope you do.
I sure will. I'll get off the phone and let you guys talk. Good night, fellas.
Henry, thanks so much
for joining us.
It's good to hear from you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Good night. All righty. Well, that was very nice to hear. He should read this book. One of the things that Courtney said about you when he was reintroducing you after the break, and he said that... and I don't know if these are the words, but I have to think that this is what he meant, and this is what I feel, is that a historian extraordinaire. I mean, this book is so rich in the detail, and after reading through it, I mean, and I'm not a Western buff, but I sure took hold of this, and I loved it, and I feel that I know so much about what was happening. It's like I said, Tombstone, I feel like I've been there. And I never have, but just because of the detail and that you go into is amazing. And after talking to you tonight, I can tell that this is an amazing passion with you.
Well, I think it's such an incredible story, and it's so much a part of our lives. I mean, there what happened in Tombstone is so similar to so many of the things that happen today, and it's just really good to know it and understand it. And as I say, I grew up in a very Western family. I mean, we were a cowboy family. We had, you know, we watched Westerns, had wore Western clothes. My family sold the ranch when I was a little kid, so the horses were gone, but my mother always rode in all the local parades and all that. So Tombstone and the West, as strange as it sounds, Tombstone and the West is still kind of courses through the blood of a few of us.
Oh, fantastic. Hey, I have to ask you one last question, and this is something that Jim likes to ask every guest, being that the show is called The Writer's Block. Have you ever had writer's block?
Yes and no. When you're a deadline journalist, like I was for a lot of years, I still work for a baseball magazine, and I write articles on the Oakland A's for Baseball America. And you learn that there are times when you have to get up and you just have to plow through. But there are also times when you're writing a book or you're writing a long essay and you're trying to be so good that you just sit there, and there are just days when the words don't come out. And I mean, writing is such a strange job. There are days when you work and work and work and you get nothing out of it. And there are days when you wake up and it just flows and you just kind of look like there's magic in the air. And it's a strange job.
I think I'm going to have my wife listen to that multiple times and say, honey, you know, it's a strange job. Thank you very much. That it was beautifully stated.
Hey, Casey, just out of curiosity, from the time that you decided, okay, I am going to write this book, till the time you completed it, how long?
About 3 years.
Really? I would have thought more.
I think everyone would have thought more, but that was 3 years of... let me see if that's about right. 1994 to 1997, probably closer to 4 years, but that's 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, full bore research. And I was really, really fortunate. What had happened, people were just starting to discover the Glenn Boyer issue, and the Glenn Boyer was false. And I had a lot of people help me a great deal. Jeff Morey, a fellow named Carl Chafin down in Southern California, John Bosenecker, who's one of the sterling and top Western writers in America, Gary Roberts, who is just like a legend in Western writing. All these people really helped me and helped contribute material, and the idea that it was that it was so important that we have a real, authentic writer biography that... people just did it. And I mean, the other part of it, people had been trying to write a Wyatt Earp biography for God knows how long. From ever since Stuart Lake, people had been trying to write another more accurate Wyatt Earp biography. And the problem was, the belief was that everything that there was to know about Wyatt Earp was hidden away in private collections, and the people holding those private collections wouldn't let it out. Excuse me. So you'd either have to have access to the private collections, or there would be no other way to write, the Wyatt Earp biography. And the main one was held by a man named John Gilcrease, who grew up in Southern California and then moved on to Arizona. And John had been contracted to write a Wyatt Earp biography in the 1950s, and he never could do it. He never could produce it and get it out. And he had this, it was believed that he had this vast amount of material on Earp that no one could write a biography without his material. And I talked to John quite a bit when I was writing it, because his editor actually befriended me and wrote the foreword for my book. Angus Cameron had been John's editor, who actually purchased John's book. And it was, and one of the most interesting things, Angus, who was one of the few people who had read John's draft of his book, when I first talked to Angus, he said, nobody knows more about Wyatt Earp than John Gilcrease. And when Angus read my manuscript, he called me and he said, you have more about Wyatt Earp than John Gilcrease did.
Well, I think you brought it forward into this book. And Casey, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. If people would like to get a hold of this book or if they want to send you questions, how do they get a hold of you or get a hold of the book?
Well, the book's on Amazon. It should be in every Barnes & Noble in the country. My other book, Mental Toughness, which I wrote with Carl and John Keel. Carl was the farm director for the A's, is also at every Barnes & Noble and on Amazon. And I don't have a web page, but I have another book, another Wyatt Earp book, actually, that I'm working on and hope to get published in the near future. And I hope to have a web page going and sometime in the future, so I'll be easier to get a hold of.
Well, again, I want to thank you for an amazingly enlightening book and interview. This has been very fun. And please feel free. We'd love to have you come back again sometime.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
All right. You have a great night.
You too.
Good night. Thank you.
Well, that was fun.
That was terrific.
He likes to talk. But he's got so much to say, and everything is just, I'm hanging on every word. I can't recommend this book enough. It was really
great.
Well,
you know, Russ, it's like what we were saying. You always to see something that everybody assumes they're familiar with because of television shows or movies or something, and then you get an entirely different version of those people and those events, and you just suddenly see things through different eyes. That's always exciting because it's like discovering something brand new.
Well, we've got about a 1 minute. Why don't you say real quickly what's going on in your life? You've got some neat things coming along.
Well, Shotgun 2 has been in the stores now for about that's the second installment. I'm writing from Pinnacle Books, Random House, and that's over at Target and Walmart and Gaymart and Barnes & Noble and Hudson's Booksellers and all those wonderful places. And I'm writing 3 and 4 right now for next year. And next April, my first book in my Captain Nemo series, Nemo Rising, comes out from Macmillan.
Fantastic.
Next April.
All right. Well, we'll look for that. And thank you for being my guide through this. You have been
amazing.
Well,
thank you, Russ, very much for letting me participate in this, because this was terrific. And you guys are always so generous to poor wandering souls like myself.
And Jimmy, listen, you get better, and hopefully Jim will be back here next week with another edition of The Writer's Block. Good night, everybody.
Listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.